You're listening to a podcast hosted by Med Learning Group.
Welcome to our podcast series titled Bispecific Antibodies for Non-Hodgkin's Lymphoma Treatment in Veterans Affairs Patients, Current Treatments, Limitations, and New Promises. This podcast is hosted by the Med Learning Group and is the first in the series of two. My name is Dr. Meenal Mouye. I'll be the host of today's podcast, investigating the use of novel bispecific antibodies in non-Hodgkin's lymphoma, adverse event profiles, and consideration for this therapy in the VA, that is the Veterans Affairs population. Joining me are Drs. Iris Issoufi and Dr. Ellis Wong. Dr. Issoufi is an associate professor of medicine, co-director adult CAR T-cell therapy program at Yale School of Medicine. She's a lymphoma specialist and co-leader cellular therapy clinical research team at Yale Cancer Center. Dr. Wong is assistant professor of medicine at Yale School of Medicine and director of the Newington Veterans Affairs Hematology Oncology Service. Hello and welcome, doctors. Thank you for joining us today in discussing this very important topic.
Thank you so much for that.
Thank you for the invitation.
So, non-Hodgkin's lymphoma accounts for about 4% of cancers in the U.S. They constitute a highly heterogeneous group of tumors that affect B cells, which are very important for our immune system, and have multiple subtypes, including diffuse large B-cell lymphoma, follicular lymphoma, mantle cell lymphoma, etc. A large subset of patients present with relapsed refractory non-Hodgkin's lymphoma. So if you were approached by a patient with a relapsed refractory diffuse large B-cell lymphoma who has already gone through R-CHOP cycles, lotazumab, Vedantin, rituximab, and CAR T-cell therapy, how would you approach this patient?
Thanks again for the invitation to discuss this topic. This is a very challenging population to treat in clinical practice because historically speaking, patients who relapse after CAR T-cell therapy setting in the third line have a very poor prognosis, particularly patients that relapse very early on within the first 3 months. And there are several reasons for why patients might relapse post-CAR T-cell therapy. About a quarter of the patients lose the CD19 target antigen because of indirect treatment-related selection of tumor cells that have low CD19 protein expression. But there are additional mechanisms in play, such as suboptimal fitness of the T cells and CAR T cell expansion in vivo, or the immune tumor microenvironment factors may play a role as well. Very importantly, there's evidence now that even in the post-CAR T-cell therapy setting, these lymphomas do maintain expression of their B-cell associated antigens, particularly CD20, which is very relevant here. I often will perform a biopsy in patients like this to look at the status of CD19 and CD20. And thankfully, we have several therapies that are approved now that target either CD19 or CD20. For example, tafasitamab is a glycoengineered monoclonal antibody that targets CD19 and is given along with lenalidomide in the relapse setting. And loncastuximab tesirine is also another antibody drug conjugate that's approved, as well as selinexor, which is another inhibitor of nuclear export. I'm very excited now about the potential to use bispecifics in this targeting CD20 in this setting because they have shown particular promise, as we'll discuss today, and they also have activity following post-CAR T relapse.
Thank you. So you mentioned that there are CD19 therapies, but also now the CD20 bispecific antibodies that are targeting CD20. Could we talk a little bit about the two currently approved bispecific antibodies for the diffuse large B-cell lymphoma?
Sure. So the bispecific antibodies that are currently approved for diffuse large B-cell lymphoma in the relapse setting are epcoritamab and glofitamab. They both target CD20 and also engage CD3, which is the activating component of the T-cell receptor. The other important factor with these bispecific antibodies is that they retain their Fc receptor, which enables them to induce a much broader immune response, engaging other immune effector cells when compared to BiTEs, for example, like blinatumomab. So both epcoritamab and glofitamab have the ability to do that. In addition, glofitamab has this unique 2-to-1 molecular configuration that allows double binding to CD20 and very high avidity binding, also with a silent Fc region, which extends its half-life and reduces toxicity. In addition to epcoritamab and glofitamab, odronextamab is also another bispecific antibody that's been under investigation and may also be approved in the near future.
So what are some of the side effects or adverse events that you have seen with these glofitamab and epcoritamab bispecific antibodies?
Some of the unique side effects for bispecific antibodies include T-cell overactivation syndromes. Two in particular we'll focus on, including cytokine release syndrome, or CRS, and immune effector cell-associated neurotoxicity syndrome, or ICANS. And so in terms of these two, the latter with neurotoxicity in general for bispecific antibodies are much less common than in CAR T therapy. So that is an advantage potentially in terms of side effect profile. But certainly for the former, this is something that we still need to be mindful of, but it is a manageable side effect toxicity for which there does need to be additional education, monitoring, and a lot of planning ahead of time. I'll ask Dr. Issoufi to comment a little bit more about some of the details in terms of some of the symptoms that are related to CRS and what are some of the management she uses in her patients.
Yeah, so I agree with you that cytokine release syndrome is probably one of the main side effects that we see post bispecific therapy, in addition to the cytopenias. And probably slightly over 50% of patients exhibit cytokine release syndrome. But as you said, it is very manageable. The majority of cases are grade 1 or 2, and minority of patients, only about 2-3%, will develop severe grade 3 or above cytokine release syndrome. And most of these events for both epcoritamab and glofitamab occur during cycle 1 of treatment. They're very short-lived, resolve typically within a couple of days and certainly before the next dose is due. And both agents are given in a fractionated step-up dosing, and that has really helped mitigate the CRS. With glofitamab, there is also a pretreatment with obinutuzumab on day 1, and the purpose of this is to provide receptor occupancy competition with glofitamab, and this helps reduce the risk of cytokine release syndrome. And in terms of the neurologic toxicity, typically that is also less common than what we see with CAR T-cell therapy, also typically seen on the first cycle of treatment, with very rare advanced grade toxicity, mostly manageable grade 1 and grade 2 events that we manage with steroids. Clinically speaking, in terms of CRS, the most common symptom is a fever, and then sometimes we can see some hypotension that's not responsive to fluids or mild hypoxia. Whereas with a neurologic syndrome, what we see is a confusional state, lethargy, micrographia or dysgraphia, and then very rarely aphasia or quite unusual to see seizure activity.
So just going back to both the drugs, both of them, or both the bispecific antibodies, both of them have different routes of administration. One is IV, glofitamab is IV, epcoritamab is sub-Q. Are there any considerations for which one to use on what type of patient?
That is the million-dollar question here. Obviously, these two agents are relatively new. They've not been compared head-to-head. We are all trying to gain experience with both. It is a discussion that I have with each patient. Because certainly some patients may prefer the subcutaneous versus the IV route of administration. Certainly, it's less time in the clinic. There are also some slight differences in the administration schedule. For example, with glofitamab, beyond cycle one, scheduling is every 3 weeks. With epcoritamab, it's a bit more frequent, especially with the initial several cycles. And then the other difference is the duration of therapy. With glofitamab, it was studied for up to 12 cycles, and then the therapy can be stopped. With epcoritamab, it is ongoing therapy. You know, there are trials with both of glofitamab, you know, being administered subcutaneously, and also with epcoritamab, limiting the duration of the cycle. So I think this is going to evolve. For now, if I have both available, it's something I discuss with a patient. Go from there. The other difference is the obinutuzumab, of course, with glofitamab, which we don't do with epcoritamab, but that does not seem to be a major limiting factor in the decision-making.
Dr. Wong, do you have anything to add to that, thinking about it from the VA perspective?
Certainly. Thank you so much. One of the unique aspects to the VA system is in the United States, it is the largest integrated healthcare system, including 172 medical centers and over 1,000 outpatient sites providing care to over 9 million veterans. And so we have such a wonderful opportunity to harness this integrated system, acknowledging there may be some unique challenges and ways to harness an integrated system to increase access for some of our veterans who may not have as much geographic access to some of these agents that historically, for example, in the initial phase one studies, the sites that were selected for participation really were sites that already had familiarity and expertise in CAR T therapy and a lot of cellular therapy and a lot of the support that you need to offer these types of agents. So one thing unique in the VA system is while we have VAs in all the 50 states and in Puerto Rico as well, each VA site is its own entity and is not identical to each other. And so while it does provide a wide breadth of care, particularly for some advanced specialties such as transplant or cellular therapies in this case, what potential for bispecific antibodies, it really, as of right now, has been restricted to very few sites. So for example, in the VA system, if someone historically were to be considered for transplant or CAR T therapy for lymphoma, they would be referred to two sites, either in Nashville, Tennessee, or in Seattle, Washington. So one would imagine that it is not the easiest for many patients to even travel to those sites to have the support system in terms of a family member or a loved one to stay for an extended period of time. Conversely, the VA has extraordinary resources that allow for the transportation, for a lot of social support in terms of resources and coordination and communication between the local provider and the providers at these specialty centers. So one of the things I think that I'm really excited to be a part of through the VA system is that as we see more and more very exciting therapies that can have major impact and potentially prolonged impact for our veterans in lymphoma care, such as these bispecific antibodies, we are trying to bridge this divide between areas that will have access to this more readily to areas of the VA where there is not as much infrastructure set up. So I think one of the things I foresee in the future is a stepwise process in terms of one is education of providers that would be caring for those patients, and also providers that would be necessary in terms of a multidisciplinary team approach. So one of the things in terms of the side effect profile is some of these agents do require inpatient hospitalization, some of them thankfully quite brief. And in one particular bispecific antibody that we'll mention a little bit later, it can be done in a purely outpatient setting potentially. So I think there's a lot of promise in terms of expanding access. And so one of the things in the VA specifically, in terms of coming together across the United States within the VA system is one of the groups I'm a part of is a VA implementation group that is developing strategies and guidance on implementation of cellular therapies, including bispecific antibody use at various VA facilities. And so in terms of that, there is involvement with our VA National Formulary Committee in terms of medications that may be needed as supportive care potentially. So for example, one of the things that our VA outpatient sites do not normally have is something like tocilizumab. And so is that something that if our patients were to be offered bispecific therapies in local VA sites, is that something that should be readily available? So things of that nature. So making sure that the infrastructure is in place, the necessary key members, the ability to act quickly in terms of potential for side effects, but also to have resources from the national in terms of our historical stem cell transplant sites who have the most experience to be able to offer a lot of support so that this can be something that, while it's not yet ready for prime time, I think this is something coming in the very near future.
Thank you for that. And you did allude to another therapy that may be becoming more important, especially in the VA setting, because it has the ability to be administered outpatient. So Dr. Issoufi, coming back to the therapy that we talked about earlier, the one that is in clinical trial, which you mentioned earlier, odronextamab, could you shed some light on how this therapy is different from the two existing FDA-approved ones, and what is the potential of this therapy?
So in terms of odronextamab, you know, that is still in clinical trials. But there have been a series of abstracts at our hematology meeting that takes place every year, and odronextamab showed significant promise in its phase one and two studies, and then more recently in phase two studies as well. It is a what's called a hinge stabilized fully human IgG4 based antibody. It also binds to CD3 on T cells and CD20 on the malignant B cells, triggering T cell mediated cytotoxicity. And the ELM 1 and 2 studies looked at its role in patients with B cell lymphomas. And at ASH, there was a very nice presentation of the results in large cell refractory or relapsed large cell lymphoma after at least two prior lines of therapy, where patients had very good overall response rates of just over 50%, with at least a third of patients achieving complete response. The progression-free survival was quite prolonged, with a median of almost 2 years, particularly in complete responders. And overall survival, the median overall survival was not reached, which is, you know, pretty remarkable for these agents, particularly when they're looked at in the third line or beyond setting, and also taking into account that some of these patients have primary refractory disease or have had autologous transplants. One third of them have had CAR T cell therapy and have progressed. So really remarkable in that setting.
So is there any potential for bispecific antibodies in non-Hodgkin's lymphoma other than diffuse large B-cell lymphoma? So how about follicular lymphoma or mantle cell lymphoma?
Yes, so these antibodies have been studied as part of phase one trials that have included a whole range of indolent lymphomas, including follicular, mantle cell, marginal zone, Waldenstrom's. And there's been a real potential in this setting of indolent disease as well. And when I say indolent, I just want to remind the audience that we're still talking about the relapse refractory setting. For example, when we look at follicular lymphoma, there is a population of patients that progress within 2 years of their initial therapy, and that's a very high-risk group. With each line of treatment, we know that for these diseases, the progression-free survival gets shorter and shorter, and by the time we're looking at third or fourth line, it's only in the order of several months. And what we've seen with these bispecifics is not only very high overall response rates that have been almost 80% in some cases, but also very high complete response rates of about 60%. And mosunetuzumab, for example, that's already approved in follicular lymphoma, which is administered also on a step-up dosing schedule in 21-day cycles. It has already been shown with a very long 3-year follow-up now that over 2/3 of patients who achieve CR are actually maintaining that. In mantle cell lymphoma as well, patients who have had prior exposure to BTK therapies and also prior exposure to CAR T cell therapy have been treated with bispecifics. For example, glofitamab already has some advanced data, including phase two in that setting for mantle cell lymphoma, showing really high overall and complete response rates. And the complete response rates have been durable as well, which is challenging because the only other lines of therapy that have been as durable in this setting probably is CAR T cell therapy, because even agents like pirtobrutinib, which is a non-selective BTK inhibitor, or other agents that we use in this setting, like venetoclax or lenalidomide or bortezomib, do not have such long duration of responses. So very exciting agents across B-cell non-Hodgkin lymphomas, including indolent lymphomas, although mosunetuzumab is the only one that so far has an approved indication. But I think with the ongoing phase 3 studies in mantle cell lymphoma as well, there may be an approval in that setting as well.
Dr. Wong, do you have anything to add to that? If not, then I can ask you my last question.
I'm just really curious to hear from Dr. Issoufi in terms of just perhaps walking us through how you manage if someone has grade 1 all the way up to grade 4 cytokine release syndrome. Sort of, are you taking care of any patients in the outpatient setting or across the board currently? Are all patients at least admitted in the beginning?
So in terms of bispecific treatments, all patients are initially getting started in the clinic. And then with glofitamab, for example, we're strictly following the FDA approvals. So with glofitamab, with the initiation of treatment, we actually are admitting them for a 24-hour observation. And then the same is true for epcoritamab, although that occurs a bit later on day 15 when they receive the first highest dose for 24 hours of monitoring. But we have instituted a system where our nursing staff and physician assistant staff will contact the patients for the first 24 and 48 hours after each dose, particularly with the first few cycles, to ensure that they're not developing any signs of cytokine release or neurologic toxicity. We always make sure that they have a caregiver before we administer these therapies in the unusual or maybe not so unusual circumstances, but when they really can't find anyone, then we will admit them for monitoring until we're sure that they've tolerated the first full dose well. And then it's quite rare for them to have issues with subsequent cycles. For patients who do develop toxicity with cycle one, we admit them again for observation with each subsequent cycle until they no longer have toxicity. We do administer pre-medications with Tylenol, Benadryl, and steroids per guidelines. These can subsequently be withheld, particularly the steroids, if the patients have tolerated the first one or two cycles well. Now, in terms of management, you know, that is very much like the management for CRS or neurologic toxicity post-CAR-T. We are currently admitting them to the hospital if they report fevers or any signs of neurologic toxicity, and we monitor them. Sometimes the fevers will resolve spontaneously. We're able to discharge them. But if they have any grade 2 toxicity, grade 2 CRS, we'll administer tocilizumab. And then if they have grade 2 neurologic toxicity, we will administer dexamethasone. I have spoken with some of my colleagues at other institutions, and some centers are giving patients steroids to keep at home. So if there is a very minimal toxicity that may not require admission to the hospital, they can be managed with steroids at home with very careful monitoring. There are some studies now, for example, with epcoritamab, there's an ongoing study looking at subcutaneous administration completely in the outpatient setting. And so many centers are participating in those trials. And then I expect in the near future, we will have that data available to make us feel more confident about moving these patients to the outpatient setting.
That was one of the things that I envision might be an avenue in terms of allowing more ready access for our veterans, whether there might be a partnership with the major academic centers in terms of potentially, I wonder your thoughts, Dr. Sufi, in terms of after perhaps the first or second cycle, if there are no CRS or ICANS concerns, would that be something that might be a plausible option to have patients get their subsequent cycles in their with their local providers?
Yes, yeah, so that's an excellent point. I mean, that's already taken place at many institutions, and we are also in the process of doing that at our institution, where we're coordinating with referring providers. And of course, this would include the VA system, but also referring providers from other practices around the state to make arrangements for us to deliver the first cycle at our institution, and then transfer care for them to get treated locally. I still am a firm believer of smaller institutions and also the VA system being able to develop the infrastructure to deliver these therapies on site, and to have the antibody treatments required on site. Because occasionally, you know, toxicity can develop later on. And I think, you know, it's very important that we reach and train as many providers as possible. And our state, Connecticut, for example, our center is reachable from pretty much most of the state. There's a, you know, 1 to 2 hour difference that patients have to travel, but in some of the larger states, they may need to travel, you know, for several hours to get to the major academic center. And then if they don't stay overnight and they're going back home, right, and develop toxicity, I mean, they're not going to drive back for 2 or 3 hours. So if something was to happen, even after cycle one, they are still going to go to their local hospital, which is why it's important for us to have these agents on site and to have a trained infrastructure of personnel and resources. You know, COVID made things a bit easier in many ways, that many hospitals are now stocking tocilizumab because it was an agent that has been used for cytokine release related to COVID. But it's important for all centers to have that agent available.
I think with our national VA leadership, that is one thing that is being explored in terms of having guidance in terms of how to deal on site with the neurotoxicity side effects, as well as the cytokine release syndrome. And as you mentioned, Dr. Sufi, having available those agents, whether it's tocilizumab, but certainly the infrastructure in terms of our colleagues in the intensive care unit, whether it's our neurology service as well, and certainly buy-in from the hematology and internal medicine colleagues in the inpatient side. So certainly, I think my experience with the VA system is that it's a very collaborative, and with an integrated system, we have ready access. We can communicate with each other through a messaging system anywhere in the United States in real time. And I think also, as you mentioned with COVID, a lot of virtual care and being able to monitor for symptoms, awareness, and having a great partnership with our nursing team as well. So I do think that is something that is being very actively thought about from the national leadership with a lot of input from various leaders within the local VA centers.
Yeah, I mean, that's a major, major advantage within the VA system, the ability to look at the medical records on real time, to have access regardless of where the patient is being treated. And that's something we don't always have available at our site. You know, we use Epic, for example, but not everyone else who is referring patients for bispecifics or CAR T is in the Epic system, and we don't always have records available, and vice versa. You know, once we send the patient back, I think that's where it becomes really crucial to have that one-to-one physician-to-physician and then nursing-to-nursing handoff communication so that patients don't fall through the cracks.
Really good discussion. Thank you both for joining us today, and especially Dr. Sufi for talking about all these treatments, and Dr. Wong sharing your perspective about the VA from the VA or sharing your perspective from the VA angle and how to make how to manage VA patients with these bispecific antibodies. Do join us for the next track, where we'll take this discussion further regarding the current clinical trial data and talk about some promising results in relapsed refractory non-Hodgkin's lymphoma treatment as presented at the American Society for Hematology Conference in 2023. And thank you all for listening. This podcast was brought to you by MedLearning Group. MedLearning Group is accredited by the Accreditation Council of Continuing Medical Education to provide continuing medical education for physicians. The CME activity was planned and produced in accordance with the ACCME essentials. I would like to give a special thank you to our grant sponsor, Regeneron Pharmaceuticals, who provided an unrestricted grant for this educational activity. Thank you.